Shrink Wrap Radio number 337, Using Dreams in Healthcare with Christopher Soden, ND.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is naturopath Christopher Soden, and we'll be discussing his new book, The Dream Working Manual, A Guide to Using Dreams in Healthcare. Dr. Christopher Soden, ND, has been a practicing homeopath and naturopath since he graduated from the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine in 1988. His practice in Toronto is a blend of classical homeopathy and psychotherapy, with an emphasis on dream work and depth psychology. Since 2003, Christopher has been focusing on training healthcare practitioners to integrate dream work into their practices. He has developed a course called the Dream Reading Method, which can be used by practitioners facilitating their clients and also by non-practitioners who are trying to get more out of their own personal dreams. He's recently published a book, The Dream Working Manual, A Guide for Using Dreams in Healthcare. For more information on all aspects of his work, see www.dreamreading.ca. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Christopher Soden, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to finally have you on the show. I really appreciated the opportunity to meet you last summer at the annual IASD, that is International Association for the Study of Dreams conference, where you gave a wonderful presentation on using dreams in healthcare. So I knew at that point that I was going to want to talk to you, and you told me you had a book in the works, and yep. The book's finally come out, and so now we can do that interview that we talked about back then.
Great.
Well, before we get into your book and your work on dreams, how about a little bit on your professional background? I know that you're both a homeopath and a naturopath. I'm not sure if everyone will be familiar with these two disciplines. I'm not even sure how much I know about them. So please enlighten us a bit.
Yeah, sure. So by license, I'm a naturopath. So here in Ontario, Canada, where I practice, the recognized license is a naturopathic one. But naturopathy is really an eclectic gathering of many different types of medicines. I guess the thing that they have in common would be that they attempt to support the body in healing itself, but they would include many things: supplements, diet, nutrition, traditional Chinese medicine, and many kinds of body work. Mm-hmm. And also here in Ontario include homeopathy under their kind of umbrella. And I'm particularly interested in homeopathy. Homeopathy is a very particular kind of medicine that was invented about 200 years ago by German doctor Samuel Hahnemann. And it basically is medicine that is chosen according to the law of similars, meaning that you choose your medicine to match the state that the person is already in. And the more similar the medicine is to the person's state, the better it will work. So it works by similarity rather than opposition, which medicine works through opposition, through opposing the symptom.
So, well, I know there's more and more openness to alternative approaches these days.
And, oh, yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, I think I'm going to have an interview down the line at some point with a listener who is a homeopath. So we'll be able to go into more detail when I do that interview.
Yeah. Okay. I think, well, one quick example I could give you of the homeopathic principle is the cold feet example. Like what do you do if you have chronically cold feet? Like, how do you make that better?
See, well, I don't know. I don't suffer from that, but both my wife and one of my sons do, and they put on.
A lot of people do.
They put on wool socks.
Yeah. What they intuitively try to do, which is essentially allopathic, is warm up their feet. You know, they'll use a hot water bottle or extra socks, or they'll put their feet on the radiator or on their husband's warm leg or whatever.
Yeah.
But what that does over time is it just weakens the whole circulatory system and makes the chronic problem even worse, because basically you're not challenging a vital response from your own body. So what the homeopath will do is the opposite. They'll take the cold feet and make them a little colder. So a homeopath would be likely to tell you, for example, if you have cold feet, to go run in the snow, which...
Oh, my goodness.
You're in Toronto now because we're covered in snow right now. And when you do that, you're challenging your body. See, you're not helping or palliating it. You're challenging it to up its game and get a bit stronger. And when you do that, the chronic problem improves because you're actually forcing your body to do something for itself rather than helping it from the outside, which has a weakening effect, even if it's a desired effect.
Well, I understand the logic of it, and I can tell you, you'd get some resistance from my wife for sure. So, what led you to follow these paths? I mean, how did you get on this particular career track?
Well, I myself had a personal experience with a health challenge. I had an allergic rhinitis issue for, you know, all through my youth and teenage years. And, you know, basically a chronic runny nose that was exacerbated by many allergens. So a traditional allopathic route and had all these crazy injections for months and months and months that were very painful. And about a year into that, I realized, you know what? This isn't doing anything. It's making it worse. And it's very painful. And I don't even like the idea of injecting all these things into my body. Yeah, so I went to a homeopath, an old timer here in Toronto, and he gave me one dose, literally one tiny pellet of a homeopathic medicine, and that chronic problem that I'd had for many years started to improve. So I was very intrigued. I was hooked from that point, and I went on to seek admission into the naturopathic college here in Toronto, which at that time was the only way that I could see available to me to become a homeopath.
And how many years have you been in practice now?
I graduated in 1988, so quite a long time.
Yeah, that's too complex math for me, but it's a long time. And so, you know, here you are presenting at a dream conference and writing a book about dreams. When did you first get interested in dreams?
Well, looking back on it, even when I was in the college as a student, I was very interested in dreams, and I was journaling my own dreams, and I was going to all the Jungian Institute seminars. So I became very interested in Jungian psychology and read everything I could about it.
Well, how did you even know about it? I mean, as an undergraduate, I never even heard of Jung.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I first picked up the trail there, but...
Well, I do remember a turning point experience for me. I believe it was in 1985, so I was still a student at the college, the naturopathic college. I went to see the wonderful film series featuring Marie-Louise von Franz, the Jungian analyst, called The Way of the Dream.
Yes, I've seen that series. It is truly wonderful.
Yeah, she's remarkable. I mean, she's dead now, but she was recognized by many people to be the greatest exponent of Jungian dream work. And very, very impressive. And I would recommend anyone who has a weekend where they want to really delve into the dream world to get a hold of a copy of that. It can be ordered from the Marion Woodman Foundation and watch it, because it's really an eye-opener. And I remember saying to myself at that time, you know what? I'm going to use this in my work. This is not going to be just an interesting personal thing for me. This is going to be more than that.
Wow.
I'm actually going to use that. I didn't know how, really, at that time. And it took me many years to actually develop a consistent dream working aspect in my practice, but I knew that I wanted to do that.
Well, what were the challenges that you faced in doing that?
Well, one of the challenges was that the dream work is not on the curriculum anywhere in medicine, including in the naturopathic college where you would expect that it might. It's really, you know, this is one of the things that really bothers me and motivates me, is that dreams seem to have lost their place in medicine and healthcare, and I really think we need to do something collectively about that. So that was one problem, that it was not considered to be a legitimate aspect of healthcare. And another problem is that when you're talking about an individual person who comes to see you for healthcare, they are not expecting, in most cases, to talk about their dreams. So you don't, if you like, there's a mandate problem. You don't have a mandate to be asked about their dreams, so you have to negotiate that mandate, and you have to essentially convince a lot of people that dream work is legitimate and related to their health.
Yeah, I can see where both of those would be challenges. So as you began to use dreams in your practice, what sorts of results did you begin to experience?
Well, what I noticed that there are, of course, different kinds of people, and people behave differently when they get sick. But I did notice that some people really just wanted relief of their symptoms and their illness. They wanted to feel better, and they didn't want to invest a whole lot of time and energy into that. And those people are usually not going to want to do dream work.
Yeah.
And then there's another kind of person who really gets the idea that we have an inner guide or an inner healer, and that inner healer speaks to us in various ways. And one of the ways is through our dream life. And they wanted to tune in that inner voice. As Von Franz said in that film series I was talking about, what we try to do is to train people to hear their inner voice and follow it through dreams. And that's what I tried to do with that second type of person.
Okay, well, I'm sure you've got stories that, you know, from doing this over the years, and feel free to throw them in at any point here that feels appropriate. I'm wondering at this point if there is a story or two that kind of stands out in this practice that you could share with us.
Okay, sure. Well, let me tell you one that involved a very important dream. I was working with a woman in her late 20s, a few years ago, and she had been a singer, a semi-professional or even professional singer for a long time, and then she'd dropped that completely and was now studying in another field and had not been singing for many years. And she reported a dream in which she was led downstairs in a house that she wasn't familiar with, and the figure who is leading her took her to a freezer, and she opened the door of the freezer, saw many frozen babies inside the freezer, and she was, of course, horrified. And then the dream went on to other parts, but when we were working, we focused in on that part of the dream because it seemed to have so much emotional impact and intensity.
Sure.
And what I did with her was help her connect it to her life, which is my goal. It's very important to, when you're doing dream work, to keep a very clear goal. My goal is just to get a connection, a resonant connection between the dream and the dreamer's life. So the connection she made was facilitated by me saying, well, what in you is frozen? And she immediately connected it to her singing.
Mm-hmm.
Still alive, and it's still in her in some sense, but it's in a deep freeze. And she immediately realized at that point that she had to start singing again. She couldn't continue to leave this vital part of herself in a deep freeze.
Uh-huh.
So she made a very significant life change based on an insight from a dream And that is the kind of work I really like to do. You know, that kind of work really excites me.
Yeah, that's a great story. And I think one of the things that I really resonate to as a dream worker myself is your emphasis on connecting to the real life, or maybe the real life is the wrong word, but the outer life that, well, it's both outer and inner, but making those connections is also kind of my focus as well. Now, the subtitle of your book is A Guide to Using Dreams in Healthcare. And so that's kind of general. What other healthcare professions do you see as this having applicability for? And I wonder if you've, I think you do some workshops, maybe you've trained some other healthcare professionals.
Yeah, that's become a really significant part of my work, is training other people to do this. Because I'm primarily in the naturopathic and homeopathic community here in Toronto, my audience largely comes from that community, but I'm really trying to extend it out to other types of healthcare workers. And, you know, I really do think anybody in the helping professions, let's expand it even just from healthcare to all the helping professions, where you're trying to help somebody else with their problems and their personal growth. So that's very wide. So that includes psychologists and counselors, pastoral counselors, spiritual counselors, and all kinds of people can all use dream work.
Sure. I'm remembering your presentation in Berkeley, though, at that IASD conference, and it seemed like a major challenge was that people aren't necessarily coming to you for a 50-minute hour of dream work.
Right.
And you might have to squeeze it into 5 or 10 minutes.
Right.
As, you know, when I think of medical doctors, I mean, that's the kind of situation they're in these days. A lot of pressure. You know, maybe you're lucky if you get 20 minutes with your MD. So
exactly. It's the time factor.
Yeah.
The time factor is one of the primary things that's working against dream work, you know, in a healthcare or helping profession context. Because as you say, even for someone who's very open to it, let's say ideally both the practitioner and the client or patient are totally open to working with this dream, and they both know it's important, but they're running out of time. You know, this happens all the time. So, we really do need, I think, a dream working style that can be done in a relatively short time. And I've devoted a lot of work and effort to developing this. And I think it's not the only option. I mean, by all means, if you have the time to lavish on a dream, take it, because it will be very valuable. The more time you've got, the better. But what often happens is, you know, the appointment's almost over and the dream comes up. Are you going to work with that dream at all, or are you going to just say, I'm sorry, we don't have time for that? And unfortunately, what happens most of the time is that the dreams are just left there, even though both parties want to work with them. It's just practically speaking, it can't be done. So what I've developed is a couple of tricks to do effective dream work in a short time. And the first one, again, has to do with the connection thing. You've got to keep your goal relatively simple. So make sure your goal is something that's achievable in a short time. So connection, by which I mean the dreamer goes, oh, yes, I see where that connects to my life.
Mm-hmm.
If you make that your goal, then you may indeed be able to achieve it within a short time. Whereas if your goal is to make a sophisticated analysis or interpretation of a dream that does justice to all the richness of the dream, then no, you probably won't be able to do that in under an hour. So both are wonderful and valuable, but, you know, we've got to be practical and work with what we can do. Another trick is to make your starting point not what does the dream mean, but instead what is the dream asking for? Because you can always look at a dream from the point of view of what's it asking the dreamer for. And if you do that, it accelerates the movement. It accelerates the whole process and gets you to a connection point much faster, in my experience.
Well, let's think about that dream that you shared with the babies in the freezer.
Right.
Does that apply there? You know, what is the dream asking for?
Yes, absolutely. Imagine you were in your office listening to your client tell that dream, and in the back of your mind, you framed the question, what is this dream asking her to do?
Mm-hmm.
And then very likely you would say, it's asking her to take the babies out of the freezer and nurture them and warm them up and give them some life, bring them back into life.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, you would have to check that out with the dreamer, because
sure,
the dreamer would have to resonate with that too. So then if the dreamer did resonate with that, then there's your answer. That's what the dream is asking for. And you not only know the meaning of the dream, you already know what it's asking the dreamer to do. So you're already at the level of making an actual practical response to the dream.
So it would help to know something about the dreamer's life, to have done an intake in which you really know something about their life, so that you would be sort of pre-armed with some material that could help you to make those connections and know what question to ask.
Right, exactly. Yeah, of course. The more you know about the person, the more likely you are to be able to help them to make a connection.
And that means you got to take time to listen to them somehow, even in a busy session. And
right.
even though, you know, we've been talking about healthcare professionals, and that's in the subtitle of your book, I really got the sense that you had a much wider audience in mind as you wrote it, and that really just about anybody could benefit from this book. Is that true?
Yes. I decided early on in the process, I thought, do I want to write a popular book for everybody, or do I want to write a book that helps to train dream workers? And I realized that I wanted to do both. So in a way, the book is kind of straddling both those, but it's primarily aimed at someone who is trying to help another person understand their dream.
Mm-hmm.
So it puts the reader in the position of the facilitator.
Yes.
And it doesn't have to be in a healthcare context. It's anyone who is trying to help another person understand their dream and get more out of it. And of course, you can even do it with yourself, but if you do it with yourself, you should divide yourself into two people, you, the one who had the dream, and you, the one who's facilitating the dream.
Yeah.
And the facilitator should use the questions and the templates and the constructs that I've developed on themselves in a way, and that actually works very well.
Yeah, you've done a lot of original work in the book, I think, really done some original thinking, and we'll be getting to that. But, you know, our brains are really tuned to be responsive to stories, and so I want to ask you if there is a dream that you can share from your own personal life that made a big impact in terms of either your own self-understanding or the direction in your life.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's lots. I have lots of dream journals going back to the early 80s. But I'll tell you one that I think was critical in turning me on to the idea of being a dream worker in my profession. And that was one I had back in my college days, when I had a dream that a dog was leading me through a dark landscape and up over a difficult barrier, and then down the other side, and then into water.
Mm.
I had to make this decision, do I want to plunge into this body of water? Okay, well, the dog says I should, so okay, I'm going to. I was trusting the intuition of the dog, and I went into the water, and soon I was in very deep water, and I saw three very large gray wolves swimming right towards me, and I thought, uh-oh. And I thought, oh, I've got to make a decision here. Do I turn and swim for shore as fast as I possibly can, or or what? Do I try to, you know, make some kind of bold encounter with these wolves? And I chose the second. I said, okay, I'm out here. This is pretty amazing. And I started to feel like I might not be killed if I swam right towards the first wolf. So I did that. I swam right into the first wolf, and he kind of disappeared. And then the second wolf, he disappeared. And then when I swam into the third wolf, it was a kind of an amazing upward whooshing of energy, as though the whole scene was being pulled up into the sky. And I woke up.
Wow, what a powerful dream. And certainly it has archetypal elements, you know, with the guide and going over an obstacle and then being led into this body of water, which often is associated with, a dive into the unconscious and then confronting these instinctual elements. How did that bridge to the understanding that, okay, I need to bring this into my practice?
Well, there were a number of things. The first one was that I was really struck by the fact that I trusted in the dog. You know, I trusted this intuitive creature to lead me where I needed to go. So I thought the dream, one of the things the dream is asking for is for me to put more trust in my inner intuition. And then, as you say, the plunging into the water, that was another thing. I equated that at the time, and I still do think it's true, that I would literally be doing a lot of my work as if in the water. That is, as if I was exploring around in the unconscious, or on the surface between the conscious and the unconscious, which is often depicted as being on the surface of the water, where the exciting part of this dream took place. And the third thing I took from it was just about, you know, going back to the homeopathic principle, you have to be courageous sometimes. If you've got cold feet, you've got to be courageous enough to make them even colder, because that's what's going to make you stronger. Not warming them up. That's going to feel good, yeah, but it's not going to help the problem. So there's something about making a decision to swim right into the face of the fears that I also felt applied to my work.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. So from your point of view, and maybe it's obvious from what you've said so far, but people might be wondering, why should we pay attention to our dreams?
Well, you know, it really comes back to this question of, do you think you have an unconscious, and B, if you do have an unconscious, does it know more than your conscious does? And I think it does, and I think the evidence is overwhelming to that effect, but I know a lot of people don't necessarily believe that.
Yeah, there are two kinds of people out there. The ones who embrace that and the ones who go scratch their head and say, what?
Yeah. But, you know, I really think if you're working on yourself and you want to change in a positive way, you have to be able to contact your unconscious somehow. You have to be able to know what's going on in the deeper, darker, unconscious parts of yourself, because they're so powerful. I mean, if you're sitting in therapy just using your conscious ego to figure out your problems, that's one thing. But if you get a message from your unconscious about why the problem is ongoing, then you're getting information that's non-ego. It's something you really didn't know. And a lot of that kind of information comes through the dream life. It's not the only way that it comes, of course. There are other ways. But the dream life is, I think, one of the most frequent and most available ways. So why on earth would you not avail yourself of that information?
Yeah, and the great thing about the dream, as compared to that sort of more ego approach that you were just talking about, is At the ego level, we can deceive ourselves, fool ourselves, etc., confuse ourselves.
Yes.
But dreams don't lie. They're utterly spontaneous. We have no control over where they came from or what they're going to say to us. And so
yep.
That's a good reason to really listen to them.
Yeah. You have to have some non-egoic source of input if you're really going to try to change yourself. So I say, why not look at your dreams? Because they're happening every night, and a lot of them are what I call ego check motifs. In other words, they provide mirroring or feedback to your ego, as if to say, hey, this is what you're doing. Are you sure you want to be doing this? Or maybe you should think about changing it.
Yeah.
A lot of dreams are like that.
Yeah. Now, many people shy away from dream work. Why would that be? Either working on themselves or doing dream work with another person?
Yes. No, I do feel, you know, pretty well suited to answer that question because I teach, you know, at a healthcare college, the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine, and I've had so many students come up to me. They're all in the third or fourth year, and they're working in the clinic there, and they have a patient. The patient brings in an intense dream. The patient is asking for help with the dream. The clinician knows that the dream is important, and they want to, of course, help the patient with it, but they have no idea what to do. So this happened to me many, many, many times, and eventually I said to myself, wait a minute, I've got to try and do something about this. I've got to help develop a method that these people who want to work with dreams can actually use. You know, so I think the main thing that stops people is that they feel lost. You know, when the patient starts telling them the dream, they panic. They don't know what to do. They don't know what to say. They don't know how to be helpful. They're lost, and they need orientation. So my dream working method is very big on getting oriented.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like there you are in somebody's dream. How do you recognize familiar elements to get you oriented towards what kind of dream message it is?
And so yeah.
I think very important. Another thing is that a lot of people, they worry that they will do harm to their patient's psyche by mishandling or misinterpreting a dream somehow. And I really think you don't need to be worried about that too much. Because what happens when you misinterpret a dream is really just muddled confusion and petering out into not much, going nowhere. It's not harm.
So I find people are very resilient, and if it doesn't ring true to them, they're just going to discount it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So I could tell you an interesting story about a student who they were working with a patient of theirs who had a dream in which they were preparing to go outside, and they opened their front door, and there was a dead squirrel lying on the doorstep. And they thought, I can't step over a dead squirrel, so I can't go out. And they woke up. So the patient brought this dream to the dream worker, who was a student at the Naturopathic College Clinic, and she started to work with it because she'd been going to a couple of my workshops. And she did a technique which I call be the part, where you actually play a part of the dream. So she asked the person, okay, could you be the squirrel? And the woman said, but then I'd be dead. At which point she got scared and she lost her nerve because she felt she might harm the patient's psyche by asking her to be dead.
Mm-hmm.
Be the part. And she unfortunately stopped doing the dream work. She said, oh, okay, well, let's move on to something else. And the whole thing was just dropped.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Because she got essentially, you know, scared of doing harm. And so she brought this to the next workshop, and it was really good to talk about that in a group setting. And the key thing there is, you know, of course, in dreams, things happen all the time that are not literal. If that squirrel, because it's a dream squirrel, may not literally be referring to something that's dead, but just something that's not currently very alive or not currently very animated. So actually what you'd be doing metaphorically when you ask your patient to be the squirrel would be to explore what part of them may not be very animated or alive currently, and which is a totally legitimate thing to do, and you would certainly not be harming them in any way.
Yeah, exactly. And I love your wording there. I might have said, you know, what part of you is dead, but I like the way you kind of add some shading to that in terms of what part of you is not animated or, you know, not fully alive. And in passing, I just want to remark how great it is that you went from that place of, you know, your early dream in which you were called to do this work and you swam and you confronted the wolves to wondering how practically you could integrate this into your work, to the point now where you're teaching in your naturopathic college that you were a student at. You're now teaching a class on this. So I think that's just a wonderful progression.
Yeah. Well, actually, I'm supposed to be teaching homeopathy. I certainly get a lot of dream work in there around the edges.
Hey, I know about that. I taught at some institutions where there was a lot of important teaching that got taught around the edges, if you will. One of the other things I really like is that, where was this question I had? You talk about, I remember you talked about this in your presentation at IASD, and I don't recall ever hearing anyone else refer to this. You talk about something you call the double resonance test, and I have to say that test resonated with me. So tell us what you mean by the double resonance test.
Well, the thing is, when you do dream work, you need a reliable way to know when you're on the right track and when you're not, when you're heading down towards a red herring or a dead end. And the way that I've developed is what I call a double resonance test, whereby when you're on to something, it's like a tuning fork is vibrating in you, and it's also vibrating in the dreamer. And when they're both vibrating together, that's double resonance. And that is what tells you that you're on the right track. So when you suggest a connection, so let's say with the dead squirrel dream, you suggested to the dreamer, is it possible that the squirrel is referring to some part of you that's not currently very alive? And then she tries that connection on, and if it starts to vibrate her tuning fork and yours is also vibrating, then you know you have what I call a resonant connection. So that's your goal. You've just achieved your goal right there. You've connected the dream motif to the dreamer's life.
I guess the reason I get so excited about that is that you have validated my intuition as a dream worker to some extent. You know, we're taught to be very cautious and very tentative and not to force any interpretations down somebody's throat. But things have sort of, in some ways, they lean so far in that direction. Hey, I've been doing dream work for, you know, 30 or 40 years at this point, and I do know something. When I hear a dream,
yeah,
you know, I know a bunch of stuff.
Right.
And so your sort of double resonance kind of affirms that.
Yes, and you should trust your tuning fork. That's the
thing.
Another thing is that beginning dream workers are, as you say, usually overcautious. And if they suspect a connection and they set it up for the dreamer and the dreamer says, no, I actually think it refers to my husband who's not very alive these days, like, for example, your tuning fork is not resonating with that connection, then you are probably right. And you should trust it. Because the tuning fork thing is actually very, very accurate. It may seem whimsical, but when you put it into practice, it's very accurate. So you really should trust your own intuitive feeling about it. And you need to sometimes challenge the dreamer. You know, not, you don't need to do it in a rude way. You would never say anything, well, no, I really don't think that's right. What you do is kind of include theirs and expand. You say, okay, that's possible, but could we also look at it as if it was an aspect of you?
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a non-challenging way of expanding the field of possible connection.
Yeah. You're very deft. I like the way that you work around these resistances. And, you know, and at the same time, I'm always having to relearn humility. And I've been in dream groups, you know, that I'm in classes where I've taught dream work, and a dream is being shared. And then some student in the dream group, their tuning fork is vibrating, and they say to the dreamer, boy, if this was my dream, and they go off on, you know, some story about if it was their dream. Right. And inside I'm going, oh my God, is that ever off the wall? You know, geez. And the dreamer lights up and says, oh wow, that's it. So, you know, somebody's,
yeah, that's right. That, but as long as, you know, as long as two tuning forks are lit up, that's very accurate. Of course, there may be more than one valid connection point.
Yes, that's true as well.
Just because you get the first one doesn't mean that's the only one. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing to keep in mind.
Sure. Now, in your book, you spell out five levels of benefit that we can get from our dream. Take us through those, if you will.
Yeah. I think that's very important, because a lot of people, they don't need to go all the way to level five, but they can still get great benefit. The first level is just simply having the dream. I mean, we all know from sleep and dream research that the sleeping brain needs to dream. And if it's deprived of that ability, then there's a decline in overall psychological health. So that's the first level. The second level is remembering the dream. And I think there's another level of benefit you get, because you're now getting the sense of a communication between the unconscious and your waking conscious state. And the third level is sharing that dream with somebody. And it doesn't have to be a therapist. It could be your partner or your friend or anybody. But sharing a dream out loud seems to bring another level of benefit, whereby the dream is much more likely to resonate in the conscious mind for a long time and bring valuable insights. Whether or not either party actually works with the dream per se, just the fact of telling it out loud is very beneficial in itself. And the fourth level, you're really into dream work. So you've kind of crossed the threshold into actively working on the dream. And that's the level of connection for me. That's what you're aiming for on level four, is making a resonant connection between the dream and the dreamer's life. And then if you can make a connection, you can go to level five, which is to respond to the insight that you just got. You actually, you know, actually do something about it in your life. Now, you can't go to level five unless you've done level four, because if you don't know what the connection is, then you don't know what you're responding to. So it has to go in that order. I kind of use the image of the nested dolls, you know, the Russian marmalade dolls. They're all each other. You have to have the one below to support the one that you're at. So it has to go in that order.
It's almost like degrees of healing, as I hear you talk about it. We believe that dreams serve a healing function even when we don't remember them. But it sounds like with each level we get kind of we move a notch up to to more healing.
Yep. And so if you want to help somebody as a practitioner, you know, keep in mind those five levels. You can go to level three, but you know, and that's very helpful in itself, just allowing them to talk about it, even without doing any formal dream work.
Yeah. Now, you also discuss different types of questions that the dream worker could use in working with someone else's dreams. And again, you created some categories. You talk about amplification questions, orienting questions, connecting questions, and responding questions.
Right.
So
right.
You give a fair amount of detail on all of these, but maybe you can take us through each of these and give an example or two.
Sure. Okay, well, let's use the dead squirrel dream again.
Okay.
An amplification question is a very open, non-leading question where you're just amplifying the dream content. You're just getting more out of it. You're getting clear about it. And that includes getting clear about what the feeling tones in the dream are, because unfortunately, a lot of people, when they record their dreams, they don't record the feelings, they just record the story. Mm. And the feelings are very, very important, because they often, that's what helps you make the connection, is feeling tones of the dream.
So what might you ask the squirrel dreamer?
Yeah, so you would say an amplification would be, what did you feel when you saw the dead squirrel?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, you know, what color was the squirrel? Or where were you going when you opened the door? Where were you trying to go to?
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are all just filling out the story and
okay.
the feelings of the story. And they're completely open and neutral, non-leading questions.
Okay.
Then at a certain point, when you feel you've got the full story, then you shift gears and you go to orienting questions. Now here, you're trying to get oriented, which is the opposite of being lost. So you're framing questions either in your own mind silently or out loud, depending, that are helping you get oriented. And one of the most common orienting questions is the inner-outer question, meaning, is the squirrel an inner squirrel, that is to say, a part of the dreamer, or is it an outer squirrel, someone or something in the dreamer's life that is they're concerned about, that is not currently animated or alive? And it could be either. You don't know yet. Only the dreamer would know for sure. But even in just framing the question in the back of your mind, you're starting to get oriented.
Or, you know, we actually have squirrels on our deck every morning that we feed.
Uh-huh.
You know, and maybe there was a dead squirrel one morning that I'm concerned about.
Could be even referring to a literal dead, non-metaphorical squirrel.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all the time it will be referring to a metaphorical, that is, the squirrel will be standing for something either in the dreamer or in the dreamer's life.
Sure.
So, but not always. It could be a literal one.
Yeah.
And then, so once you get oriented, you shift gears again and you go to the connecting level, whereby you're using a formal construct to help set up a connection. So an example of that would be, is there some way in which you feel not currently alive, or a part of you feels not alive? So you've already suspected a connection, but mm-hmm. you don't want to just say that to the dreamer, because it's always more valuable if they arrive at the connection themselves in their own way,
mm-hmm. yeah.
more resonant and long-lasting. And
mm-hmm.
so what you do is you try to set it up for them, and they will, if they can make the connection and say, yes, you know, ever since such and such a time, I haven't wanted to go out much because I feel this part of me is just dead. So, like, say the part of me that wanted to go out dancing is dead. And
yeah.
there, they've resonantly connected to the squirrel there. And they did it. Like, you didn't do it for them. It's, you know, that's why setting up is always better than telling them what you think.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about responding questions?
Yeah, so then once you've made the connection, you shift again and you go to level 5 and you say, okay, now what could we do about this dead squirrel situation?
Ah.
What can you think of something that would help bring that part of you back to life again?
Mm-hmm.
And then again, you don't tell them what you think they should do. You try to create the conditions whereby they could generate an idea themselves.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah, so those are very different types of questions, and you got to be clear about which type of question you're asking at which point. And another thing I just want to say because I train dream workers a lot. Don't ask long, rambling, multi-phrase questions.
Yes.
Because the dreamer gets overloaded. They don't know which part of your question they should be responding to. Your questions should be quite short and just one at a time. If you need to know three things about the squirrel, you just ask one at a time. Don't ask all three. Because, you know, the poor dreamer doesn't know what they're answering. They may have forgotten the beginning of the long question
right.
before you get to the end of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like such a simple thing that you're saying there, but it's certainly something that I have observed a lot, you know, working with students around this. And I can't remember if it ever occurred to me to make such a simple statement as you've made here, but it's really an important guideline.
Yeah.
Now you've got another set of categories that you lay out in one of the last chapters of the book, where you go over what you call 12 common dream motifs.
Yeah.
And I won't ask you to take us through all 12 of them. People should go out and get the book, for heaven's sakes. But perhaps you can tell us what you mean by a motif and take us through one or two or three of them.
Yeah, okay. So a motif is a smaller unit than a dream. So a dream can have several motifs in it. Mm-hmm. I would say a motif is a unit of meaning or within a dream.
Oh.
So it's, for example, to take the very common dream of you're driving and you're having troubles controlling the car. Let's say the brakes aren't working very well, so you can't slow down very well.
Oh, yes, I know that dream very well.
Yeah, very common type of dream in our culture.
Yeah.
So that's a motif. The motif of the brakes not working well and anxious about not being able to slow down. That's a motif. Mm-hmm. It could exist within a much larger dream with many other motifs. But that motif is a unit of meaning in there. It's asking for something. It's like the smallest unit of the dream asking for something, I would call a motif. So that motif almost always, in fact, I would go out on a limb and say always, is asking you to be aware that you're going too fast in some area of your life and that you're having trouble slowing down. And it's also asking you to try and do something about that, actually address that situation.
Okay, but that's very helpful. But you list these 12 common dream motifs, and I don't think there's one in there about can't control the car motif.
Be an example of what I call an ego check motif.
Meaning,
mirroring communication from your unconscious. The unconscious is holding up a mirror and saying, look how fast you're going, and you're really having trouble slowing down when you need to. Are you sure you want to keep doing this, or should you try to change this?
Yeah, because when I first saw, you know, motifs, common motifs, I thought, okay, there's can't control the car, there's teeth falling out, there's flying, etc. But you have a broader way of categorizing these.
My way of categorizing is essentially, again, based on what the dream is asking for, what kind of thing it's asking for. So ego check motifs are always, they're some version of, hey, this is what you're doing. Are you sure you want to keep doing this?
Mm-hmm.
So they're asking for a possible change of the ego position or the ego attitude.
Okay, that's very helpful. Let's talk about what about the flying dream? Does that fit into a motif?
Well, the flying dream in a way is a little bit different for me because it's a universal motif that I think everybody has, whether they remember it or not.
Okay,
you know, probably all higher mammals have some version of that dream, I would bet. I really believe it has to do with the soul, you know, the soul meaning the part of us that is not tied down by gravity and being in a body and time and place and weight and all those things. We have a part of us which really likes to get away from all those things and just have the sheer ecstatic joy of flying. And so flying dreams are like a universal positive experience that I think we can all enjoy. So yes, that is a motif. And very often what you'll see with flying dreams is there's some problem with the flying, like can't get off the ground, or you get up for a short time and then you become frightened and you come back down. So those flying problem motifs are very important because they're showing that there's some soul problem that needs to be looked at.
I'm trying to remember, is there a soul or transcendent or spiritual motif in your categorization?
Well, one issue in working with dreams is that you have to be very clear about your terminology, and you have to define your terms, because a lot of these terms like soul and spirit are used in different ways by different people.
Mm-hmm.
The way I use the word soul, which is entirely based on dreams and what I've noticed from people's dreams, is that the soul is the part of the human being that is not tied into the body and all the limitations of the body. And spirit is slightly different to me. The spirit, or what I call the personal spirit, is the part of the person that has a continuous sense of self and a continuous sense of personal history. And that is the part that can be damaged by trauma. So when there's an unbearable trauma, there's a break in the personal history, and that creates a very characteristic dream motif, which I call the personal spirit motif, which is very often depicted as an abandoned child or baby.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the most important kinds of dreams in healthcare, or for any use of dreams, because it's saying you have been split off from yourself in some way because of a trauma that caused a rift, and that part of you that split off is depicted in this dream as this abandoned child, and it is very urgent that you now try to reestablish connection with that child, because the psyche wants to be healed and whole. It does not like being split like that, and it will keep producing that inner child motif, if you like, or the personal spirit motif in dreams, in an attempt to appeal to the ego to reestablish that connection and heal that trauma. So that's a very, very important, and again, very common type of motif.
Well, Chris, I love your clarity, both in this conversation and in your book. As we begin to wind down, I wonder if there's anything important that we've left out or a thought that you'd like to leave our listeners with.
Well, I'd like to mention the fact that the ISD upcoming conference in June of 2013, which is going to be in Virginia Beach, part of it is going to be devoted to this question of dreams and healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of splitting off a 1 or 1.5 day part, which will be kind of a symposium where a lot of people who work in the healthcare context will be talking about, you know, this really important question of how do we get dreams back into healthcare? Dreams in throughout human history often have held a very, very important, even central place in healthcare traditions and healing traditions. But that is not currently true mm-hmm. in our society. So
yeah.
What are we going to do about this?
Yeah. Are you the person who set that up?
Well, yeah. I was one of the catalysts for that. And in talking with Bob Vandecastle, who's one of the main organizers of the upcoming conference, he thinks this is a very important area, and its time has come. Because, you know, at the ISD conferences, there are a lot of healthcare workers, of various kinds.
Sure.
And a lot of people are working with dreams, but in very disparate contexts. But there are some people working in hospital settings, in hospice settings, in small clinics, I think it's time for us to start pulling together and really bringing this question to the forefront. You know, what would it take to get dreams back into the curriculum at medical school, for example?
Yeah. You know, you might want to reach out to the Jungian analyst, Robbie Bosnack, because he has created a sort of Asclepian-style healing center in Santa Barbara. So he might be a good person to have on the panel.
That would be a very good idea, yeah. So I'm going to be there talking about this from the point of view of, you know, working with dreams in an alternative healthcare practice. And I know some hospice care workers and some nurses will be on the panel. But, put the word out there that, you know, you're a disseminator of dream news. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Tell people about it, because I really think it's something that it really needs to be addressed at a grassroots level. You know, there needs to be a movement about the validation of dream work within medicine, and we need to gain back some ground that has been lost.
Yeah. Well, you have just disseminated that information, and I'll just add that anybody can join IASD and anybody can attend this conference. Mm-hmm. So you can go to the website. Well, I'll put it in the show notes, but I think it's IASD.org. Does that sound right?
I think it's asdreams.org.
Oh, that's it. Yes.
Yeah, asdreams.org.
Okay. Well, Dr. Christopher Soten, it's really been great to talk with you here. And I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're very welcome. It's been a real pleasure, Dave.
I hope this conversation with Dr. Christopher Soten has reinvigorated your interest in dreams. I'm not sure if you heard some problems in the audio or not. We started out with him on Skype and had to restart Skype twice because Skype began to drop words from what he was saying. On the third try, we switched to his landline phone. I think I pretty successfully joined the different pieces together seamlessly, I hope. Did you notice the breaks? Personally, I've never consulted a naturopath and have always been a little skeptical of homeopathy, though I have friends who swear by these alternative approaches. I may have to revise my own stance because Christopher is so intelligent, clear, well-spoken, and knowledgeable about Jungian psychology and dream work that he has a halo effect on me. My sense is he's somebody I would trust to visit for a consultation or treatment. I think his techniques for shortening the dream work process to fit into the work of busy health practitioners is groundbreaking. Much of what he writes about is familiar to me from the many other books and workshops I've attended on dream work. At the same time, though, I think he's done a brilliant job of reconceptualizing the standard lore and also has introduced many original ideas and dream categorization schemes. The book is easy to read, and it's laid out in a very practical way with box insets on nearly every page containing a dream working tip. For example, here's a dream working tip from page 160. The headline in the box says, "What if you can't make a good connection?" The text says, "If you're not able to make a resonant connection and you're running out of time in the session, then it is quite all right to simply declare it's a work in progress. Ask the dreamer to give it some more thought before your next session and make a note to yourself to check in with him at that time. Some dreams are not understood for months or years after they occur, often because the dreamer's outer life has not caught up with his inner life." So that's a good example of a dream working tip in the book. And he also includes lots of dream examples. I think both novice and experienced dream workers will find much to like in this book.
Hi, Dr. Dave. I wanted to thank you for the remarkable podcast series that you've put together. I've been listening for many months now as I run, and I'm like a kid in a candy store. This is really a remarkable reservoir of information. I do have a check off to you, and I encourage everyone to think about how just valuable your service is. The book review aspect alone is incredible. It's really allowed me to focus on what I'd really like to read and buy and to glean the essentials of something that I might have interest in but perhaps not adequate time. As I mentioned, I'm a long-distance runner, and so I listen to you a lot. I find your podcast educational, entertainment, kind of a secondhand therapy. One of the things I've learned from your podcast is that exercise is as good as meditation, so I guess I get a dose every time I go for a run. All kidding aside, it's just remarkable. It's a valuable service and a real gift. So I ask everyone to look into their heart, look at their watch and the time that you save them, and look in their wallet and make a contribution so that you can continue doing this good work. Thank you so much. As a full-spectrum listener, I really appreciate it. God bless.
Thank you, listener Jan, for that ringing endorsement and for encouraging others of you to click on that big multicolored support button in the right-hand sidebar on our site, where you can use PayPal, a credit card, or information for sending a check. Moving on to other news, I'm happy to announce yet another CE course. It's another installment in my series on mind-body psychotherapy. This one is titled Neuroscience and Healing, and it features my interviews with Jaak Panksepp, Eleanor Criswell, Michael Heller, Stanley Kellerman, Paul Swingle, Robert Scheer, Mark Solms, and Bruce Ecker. What a package, if I do say so myself. For listening to these interviews with these luminaries and answering some true-false questions about each one, you can earn 8 continuing education units for less than $10 each. Just go to the Store tab on the Shrink Wrap Radio site and scroll down to the bottom of that page, and you'll find this one as the most recently added course. Just click on the link that you see there, and it will take you to the course information on the Zur Institute site. If you offer depth-oriented psychotherapy or other depth-oriented services, be sure to click on the depth list icon in the right-hand sidebar, which will take you to a chance to list your specialty in a geographical database on the Depth Psychology Alliance website. Right now, listing is free. That means free advertising for you. And speaking of freebies for you, you'll also find a text link in the right-hand sidebar that says, click here to earn money taking online surveys. That will take you to one of my marketing research partners who pays people to take surveys. So it's not quite free, but for a bit of your time, you can make some moolah, and a little slice will go to help support this show.
Hi, this is Genpo Roshi, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Genpo Roshi, who will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. Now let's go to some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Sue, who posted the following comment in response to my interview with Dr. Louis Cozzolino. She writes, if the findings of neuroscience can help some people approach therapy with less fear, that's great. To externalize the problem can be helpful, but it's also equally important that we don't use neuroscience findings to rid us of our personal agency or to make scientific our human struggles and experience, because it could rob us of the opportunity to change and to understand each other. Does it really help me to say, quotes, I'm not, or I am hardwired for, dot, 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 instead of I struggle with, or to, dot, dot, dot. Keeping in mind that change is always an ongoing work, not a destination. Neuroplasticity, likewise, is a potential, not a means to an end. For me, neuroscience is exciting because its facts speak to my yearning to put an end to uncertainty. Yet the promising, uplifting language of neuroscience should be tempered with a grain of salt. The term rewiring in particular is seductively mechanistic. Having had psychotherapeutic help over the years, it's an ongoing work and struggle to grasp and apply understanding, to continue to learn. Sometimes I forget what I learned. It's not a linear path or a quick fix, if only. For this reason, I don't in any way regard the therapy I had as a biological intervention. Saying that psychotherapy is a biological intervention implies that somehow my brain has been rewired and reconfigured, and by inference, permanently changed for the better, that I cease to struggle to make my sense of my experience, to understand my behavior, my feelings. Every day, my experience tells me that this is not true. The findings of neuroscience can tell us what happens biologically in our brains, but what kind of understanding of the mind and our personal experience does this knowledge constitute? You can't have a mind without a brain, that's certain, but it doesn't follow logically that the brain and mind are the same thing. They aren't. Well, I wanted to read that comment. I don't always read all the comments, but I'm sure not all of you go and check to see what kinds of comments have been posted. And I thought this one was particularly thoughtful and raised some really good points. It kind of temper my own enthusiasm, which is always a good thing. Now, Richard also posted a great comment on the Cozzolino interview. And Richard wrote, "Thanks for a great interview. Dr. Cozzolino is, without doubt, deeply rooted in the development of both psychotherapy and neuroscience over the past few decades. The argument of the need for neuroscience knowledge in the ability to practice psychotherapy is a curious one. All information is of value to both specific knowledge and also our capacity to intuit the wider picture." Steven Pinker once commented, and I paraphrase, on counterintuitive thinking. "The more I know, the less counterintuitive my thinking is." Lou has created a wonderful chapter in the second edition regarding epigenetics, and this may prove to be as exciting and informative as was the understanding of the malleability of the synapse. I also recommend that people read his books, and there are a number of them. Looking forward to your next interview, and that's from Richard Hill. And so once again, indication that I have very sharp listeners out there with good critical facilities, often better than my own. Next, we hear from Crystal, who writes in response to my thanks for her donation. And Crystal writes, "David, what finally prompted me to get off my derriere and contribute was hearing you read a couple of emails from other contributors. I felt embarrassed to be reaping the riches while offering nothing. I'm a little shy about doing an audio clip, even if I could figure out how to do it. This morning, my husband and I listened to the Jaak Panksepp interview, which was terrific. I'm really impressed by how you manage such a mix of personalities and subject areas. My husband ordered Jaak's book off the Amazon link on your site, and we'll try to do that going forward. I want to add one more person to my request list, Diana Foscia. Thanks for all the great work." And that's from Crystal. Well, let me start with the last point about wanting me to interview Diana Foscia. Turns out that I did already interview Diana Foscia, and that was on my Wise Counsel podcast series. Now, over 100 interviews are still available there in case we have new people who don't even know about that other podcast that I did for a number of years. There's something like 125, really good if I say so myself, interviews there. And I interviewed Diana Foscia in 2011. And so if you go to www.wisecounselpodcast.com and then go to the archives and then do a search on the name Diana Foscia, you will find that interview there. I'm glad to hear that reading these emails from people who have donated has motivated at least one person to become a donor. And as you know, I'm now trying to get everybody who currently donates or has donated in the past to send me an audio clip, and I'll play that instead of some of the other promos that I've been playing, just to change things up, and also because I think that it really does send a powerful message when you hear a listener speaking and giving their own testimonial in their own words. And Crystal said she feels a little shy. I hope she can overcome it. And Crystal, you said, even if I could figure out how to do it, well, the easiest way to do it is to use our phone number, our message number that I give at the end of each episode. And that number has recently changed, so I'll give it here right now, and then I'll give it again at the end. It's 206-350-9918. Next, we hear from Nikki, who also is writing in response to my thanks for her donation. Nikki writes, "Hi, Dave. What a treat to hear back from you in a personal email. What a contrast to automated generic script. How very related and human. Thank you. You are most welcome for the money. It only seemed right to reciprocate for the wealth of persons you've helped me be exposed to and the riches of information I've learned via your podcasts. I hope it nourished your soul because you have surely served up soul food for me. I will put together something to say and leave it on your voicemail. Yay! It might take me a bit of time because my schedule is what it is. I am a Jungian analyst and a wannabe shaman. I commute to city life to live out the former and then return to rural landscapes for the latter. Your interviews accompany me in my travels, be they while I traverse over the asphalt or in my interior landscapes. With kindest regards, Nikki." Well, I'm really thrilled to have a Jungian analyst listener. You may not be the only one. I have interviewed quite a few Jungian analysts, and hopefully you'll find those interviews. I think you're a relatively new listener, so there's lots to look for. And I did send Nikki a link to my interview with a Jungian shaman. That was, I think, episode number 47, if I recall correctly. So others of you might be interested in that one as well. And so I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments, as you heard today, about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-350-9918. And again, please note that this number is different than the one I've given out in the past. Turns out, if I don't receive an email, a voicemail at least once a month, they will terminate that service. I didn't realize it, and somebody tried to leave one, and they wrote me and told me, "Hey, did that service close down?" So that alerted me, and so I signed up again, and I got the new number. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Christopher Soten, for his tips on using dreams, particularly in healthcare. My next guest will be American Zen Master Roshi Jinpo Mirzel, and we'll be discussing his book, Big Mind, Big Heart. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.